Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon. Here we are in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. We're going to jump right into it and say hello to Ian Scher, who is a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. You know, it's all about Facebook again today, like it is so often. But tell me this story where they've set up this war room now, made a little bit of news today that to try to stop this fake news.
Yeah, so in an effort to really kind of show us that they're on it, Facebook has put together this very dramatic conference room that has a bunch of people in it. There's 20 people from different teams working with as many as 20,000 people around Facebook throughout the world. And what they're doing is trying to really react to false stories and fake news and whatever else is popping up in the moment as much as they can. And they gave us a couple of examples. They actually brought reporters in yesterday to take a look at it. And, you know, one of the examples they brought up was during the Brazilian presidential election. There was a lot of fake news going around, very similar to what we dealt with during the 2016 election. And they said they were pretty proud at how quickly they were able to pull stuff down, and they think they're getting better at it. So it's interesting to see them do this. On some level, it's very much a political thing that they're, you know,
sure,
they're showing
us this
war room. They're showing us this dramatic example of what they're working on. But, of course, there's still criticism that they're not doing enough.
And it comes right. Wasn't there a move earlier this week from several, including Illinois state treasurer, to try to put into motion this framework that would allow them to remove Zuckerberg? I don't quite understand that, but I know that there's a bit of a revolt with people who are invested in Facebook.
Yeah, so, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, has the controlling shares of Facebook. So he actually is able to pretty much do whatever he wants. But every year during the shareholder meeting, during which all the different shareholders of Facebook can vote on things, one of the things that has popped up for this year is that they, the Rhode Island, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New York City comptroller have all signed on to the shareholder proposal that Mark Zuckerberg would be pulled down from being chairman of the board of directors. So this is the, you know, the board of directors are people who kind of oversee the CEO and kind of keep the management team in check and represent people who are acting on the behalf of the shareholders, making sure that the company doesn't do things that wouldn't be best for shareholders. And removing him as chairman would be a very political thing. It would be very symbolic, right? He'd still be CEO. But it's an interesting thing to see, and I'm sure that in the end it's probably not going to end up anywhere, but it's interesting to watch.
And the state treasurers, Mike Frerich here, they do it because they've got state pension money invested in Facebook, right? That's where they get their
clout. Exactly.
And look,
a lot of people make these kind of efforts to try and make a point to the company that they're unhappy. And that's the thing that's going to be interesting. However many people vote on this, if it gets a large number of votes, it's going to be a message to Zuckerberg that things need to change.
All right, let's go to Google. And there's this story where they've been working on a search engine that's got stuff filtered out in an effort to please the Chinese government, right? They've been out of China. They want to get back in. And so they're helping China sort of censor the searches?
So it's really weird, right? So Google was in China for a number of years, and then they pulled out in 2010 because the Chinese government was found to be hacking Google and a number of other tech companies. And it was very dramatic. And, you know, there's 1 billion people in China. It's a huge market. And to see them leave was a pretty big deal. So now, apparently, they're testing, seeing whether or not they can go back in. And one of the things the CEO, Sundar Pichai, said earlier this week is that they had tested it using all of the rules that the Chinese government has, and they found that they can help people about 99% of the time with whatever they want, right? So as long as they're not looking for Tiananmen Square or stuff like that that the Chinese government doesn't want their people to learn about.
Well, it's funny to
Google
me.
Google is able to do it.
We're a little late here, but it's funny to me how they phrase it like, well, we can help people 99% of the time. Or you could also say, well, we're filtering out the 1% of information that the Chinese government doesn't want them to hear.
Exactly.
I mean, they will be participating in censorship, which is, you know, contrary to what most internet companies are all about.
And that's why they're getting criticized up and down and left and right. A lot of people are saying, well, wait a minute, you took a moral stand 8 years ago. Where did that go? And a lot of people inside Silicon Valley and even in Google are very upset about this.
Ian Schur is the senior editor at CNET. Check out those stories and more. Thanks for joining us today, Ian. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. In the studio now, Bill Geiger. Our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good afternoon, sir.
We should have just been recording what we were talking about during the break, because I was pretty interested in that. The news this week about Sears, right?
Right.
And you know, I've been talking about Sears on this show for a long time, and the fact that it kind of was inevitable that things were going to happen, and now we talked about them filing bankruptcy, and that has a big impact on people who are holding a Sears pension.
Well, it does, unless you took the lump sum option, and let me tell you what that means. A lot of pensions, including Sears.
Before we get to that,
yes,
though,
go ahead.
So if I'm holding a Sears pension,
yes,
and I see the news that they're going to file, you know, Chapter 11, I'm starting to freak out. I'm going to lose my pension. Well, I see from the government, we've talked about this government board that protects these pensions.
Benefit Guarantee Corp.
PBGC. That they're covered, that these workers are going to be protected.
Not necessarily.
What do you mean, not necessarily?
Not necessarily. You remember the story about my father, the company he worked for, declared bankruptcy, just like Sears is doing. And the PBGC came in. That's the first thing that happens. They took over the pension. The second thing that happened is they cut my father's pension in half for the rest of his and my mother's life.
So his pension was protected, but it wasn't
fully
full
protected.
Pension. Right, right.
It wasn't fully protected. He didn't lose it completely, but he lost half of it.
So the Sears workers are hearing from the government that their pension is protected. Should
not sleep too well yet.
Right. Okay.
There's a review process that the PBGC goes through. The Sears pension plan is $1.5 billion underfunded. I mean, it has $1.5 billion less than what they need.
Right.
My guess is they get done with the review process, there's going to be cuts to those pensions. Whether it's a little or a lot, we don't know yet.
Okay, so then that brings us to people who, when they were retired, might have been offered a lump sum.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know this, but a lot of pensions, like Sears had this too, is you had the option that you could take a big chunk of money at the beginning of your retirement and take that money and go create your own pension
right.
plan. And a lot of folks did that, particularly higher compensated people did that. And they're just fine right now.
Because they've got their money in other vehicles.
They got their money in other vehicles. And this is the problem with pensions. You retire with a pension from a company that you used to work for, you have to depend upon your company making great financial decisions for the next 25 or 30 years.
So I don't know about you, Bill, but I've been playing the Mega Millions game in my mind.
I'm ready.
And I'm taking the lump sum there. But this is kind of what we're talking about, right? Because
yeah.
You take the lumps, you look at the, you know, guaranteed over time, it's a bigger number than the lump sum.
Yeah, if over time ends up working out.
Or if you live that long.
If you got a $900 million lottery, and you take $500 and some million, you don't have to worry about the health of the pension plan.
And that's what we're talking about, right?
You're taking I'm going back and forth.
Yeah, you're taking a lower number, potentially lower number, but you've got in control of it, and it's going to pay off dividends for you down the road.
Yeah, and in most cases, you can do as well as privately as what your pension would have been, sometimes more.
Right.
On top of that, in a traditional pension, when you and your wife are gone, there's zero left. If you create your own private pension using that lump sum, at the end of you and your spouse's life, there may be a legacy for your kids.
Well, people who go through this, I think, are tortured by the decision. Is it always the right thing to do to take the lump sum?
It's not, but it's a question you should ask.
Okay.
And we help people with this all the time, Steve. This is I mean, literally all the time, because there's a lot of pension in this area, and we run the calculations, and we help them decide what's the best course to take.
All right, let's go in the Wayback Machine. It's 3 years ago. I'm retiring from Sears,
yeah,
and I knock on your door and say, Bill, I'm about to retire. I can collect a pension, or they're going to give me a lump sum. What do we look at, or how do we get it done with you?
Well, we look at how big that lump sum is. We look at what kind of payments you can create on your own. Okay, and if it's anywhere close to what your projected annuity payments are going to be from the pension, it's a no-brainer, Steve,
right?
Because you have control, and you end up with something left as a legacy.
We talk about this all the time, about the beauty of knowing or having some confidence that you know the money's there and it's going to be there for you.
Yeah, and that used to be the strength of pensions.
Well, I was going to say, that's what I always thought. That's why I was envious of people with a full pension.
Yeah, that used to be the strength of pensions. But now, I mean, there are so many underfunded pensions in this country. They won't tell you that.
Right.
But when you dig underneath the numbers, you can find out that they are truly underfunded. And with companies being bought and sold like Chinese checkers,
right,
the new owner may not like to have that pension anymore.
So so let's say you're not retired yet, but you're getting close, and you are at a pension system. Can you pre-retirement go to your employer and say, "Do I get it? I mean, should people start planning now to look at the question that maybe I could get a lump sum?"
Oh yeah, if you're in late 50s, early 60s. And you got a pension, you should be asking this question, or you should be getting some help with this question.
I've been asking because I've got a couple small pensions. I've been looking into it because of
yeah.
You. Yeah.
Steve, anybody out there is listening. Folks, if you're in the audience listening, you have that option. Give us a call. We can help you make the right decision. And Steve, I know you're going to talk about a complimentary plan for folks. We'll do that as part of your plan also.
Excellent, Bill. Great to see you again. We'll do it a couple weeks or so.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks very much, Eric Rung. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. All right, while we're in the family, let's just stick with it. Melissa Donaldson is on a phone line. She's the Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer at Wintrust Financial. Melissa, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate you having me on this beautiful, sunny Chicago afternoon.
It's the best time of year, isn't it, Melissa?
Indeed.
Okay, let's talk about diversity in the financial services industry. I mean, we talk about diversity a lot on this program, and the values, the value of it when it comes to a business. But speak to that specifically when it comes to banking or elsewhere in the financial services industry. How important is diversity?
Absolutely. Diversity and inclusion, in fact, are two very important factors in the viability of the industry, we believe, because it could have a negative impact on the competitiveness of the Chicago region and the financial services as an industry on the whole if there is a lack of diversity and a sense of equitable economic opportunity amongst the various communities in the region.
You used two terms there, and I'm not sure I understand the difference. You said diversity and inclusion. What's the difference between the two?
So diversity is really about, at its core, the differences that are used to establish one group from another. So it's just a way to identify, genders, racial, ethnicity, et cetera, versus inclusion is really how we fully utilize all the experiences, backgrounds, and resources that the talent who are coming from diverse backgrounds are bringing into the workplace.
So diversity doesn't have much help if you don't listen to those diverse voices, and that's the inclusion part.
Absolutely.
All right, so
you got it.
You're part of this Financial Services Pipeline Initiative, and I know they've got a big summit coming up later. I think it's on Friday, in fact. Does it center on automation, or tell me about the summit coming up?
Yes, so this is our fifth annual Financial Services Pipeline Initiative, and if I just could take a quick moment and describe what the FSP really is, which is a consortium of 18, 19 of the locally the largest banks and financial services firms that are all working in a very collaborative manner to look at how to really close the gap in representation of African Americans and Latinos in Chicago's financial services industry. So we're having our fifth annual annual fall summit to really look at what are some of the advancements that are coming our way in the coming years, and as well as what are some of the accomplishments that we have collectively been able to achieve during this past year. So the summit will describe everything from what the future of work is going to be like, which is how the advent of AI and artificial intelligence and technology is going to have an impact on the workforce in some way, shape, or form. And then we'll also hear from Dr. Olby, who is a neuroscientist, and he's going to talk about how power has an impact on the brain and how that has an impact on driving inclusivity in general.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and then we'll also talk about, from a legal component, of course, when you can't talk about diversity and inclusion without talking about data, right? And so we'll also have a segment where we will talk about how to appropriately and responsibly leverage the data to drive some of our initiatives.
Well, I want to go back to the AI, because it's hard to be diverse if all the workers are robots, right? I mean, is that a threat?
AI certainly is a threat, just from the standpoint of the speed and volume that technology and robots, et cetera, are able to do the work of several humans rolled into one. And you're right, we haven't looked at the diversity of robots.
Right.
I think that's a bit out of scope for us, but we're looking at it from the standpoint of how automation and artificial intelligence will assume some of the jobs, the roles and responsibilities that individuals today may hold. And so it's an area that we're just starting to explore as a collective, but we know that it is going to definitely have an impact, just as it does on many other industries.
I mean, I would imagine if you want to spread out or increase your diversity, a lot of that involves bringing people in at the entry level. If more entry level jobs are done by robots, that makes it harder, or maybe it just raises the level of the entry.
Absolutely, and we do know that oftentimes it is women and minorities and older workers that do tend to have some of those jobs that are more at that front line level.
Yeah.
At risk, yeah, and so those are areas that we're, again, just starting to look at. But we know that one of our opportunities for the industry on the whole is to ensure that we are retaining the talent that we have and developing that talent to be prepared for greater opportunities inside the organization. So promotion is a really big area of focus for us.
Melissa Donaldson,
overall,
the VP of Chief of Diversity Officer at Wintrust. Melissa, it was great to talk to you. Thank you very much. I hope we can do it again.
You too, Steve. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You bet. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. So I'm not paranoid about robots becoming our overlords or anything, but Boeing might have changed that. Chicago's big-time airplane maker is looking towards the future by showing interest in computing that mimics the synapses of the human brain called neuromorphic processing.
First robot dogs, now brain computers? Are you kidding? I'm out of here.
Boeing thinks that it's going to be the key to developing our aerospace adventures in the near future. And I usually don't get political here, but this is a business lesson to learn from. The fact that Governor Bruce Rauner and Challenger J.B. Pritzker released their 2017 tax returns. And looking at it, if you've ever wondered what it's like to be a billionaire, turns out it's expensive. But that's not the point. The importance of this is the transparency. The business world has done a relatively good job at adapting to the needs and transparency that people demand. Consumers, constituents, residents, whoever, they're usually more open to things if they aren't left in the dark. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. It's 12:52 in the afternoon. On the phone line now is Dr. Thies Boorma, who is a professor at the University of Manitoba, but is also the director of the Department of Information, Evidence, and Research at the World Health Organization. So it's interesting to me that these numbers are going up, and I want to talk to you about some places in the world where, well, let's just go there now. There are some places in the world where they're kind of astronomical, right? I mean, was it in Brazil where it's Dominican Republic, I should say, 58% of all births were done by C-section in 2014, 55% in Brazil. So what is it that is leading some of these countries to lean so much toward a C-section?
Well, I think, first of all, we have enormous diversity in the extent to which countries use cesarean sections. So you're right, you mentioned two countries in Latin America and Caribbean, Brazil and Dominican Republic, over 50%. But we also know of countries like Egypt is well over 40%, Turkey, Iran. And so it varies a lot. And then at the other end, we have countries where there is less than 10% use of cesarean sections, and in, for instance, West Africa, it's only 4%, and that's where there is a severe shortage.
So it's interesting. There are two sides to it, right? It needs to be accessible to people. It needs to be accessible for health reasons, but then you don't necessarily want it overused. So when you talk in West Africa, maybe accessibility needs to be increased there, but in places like, well, even in the U.S., where it's 32%, maybe we need to rely on that a little bit less.
Absolutely. I think the World Health Organization recommends that sort of an optimal use of cesarean section is somewhere between 10 and 15%. So we know that if it's much higher, that a lot of women are getting cesarean sections, which are unnecessary. There are no clear medical indications to get those cesarean sections.
So is it done for? Is it done out of convenience?
Well, it's quite complex, and it varies also between countries. So on the one hand, one could say there are factors that the women sort of want a cesarean section because there's a fear of normal delivery, labor pains, fear of poor quality of care, etc. But there's also factors that one could think of that are in the system, that doctors believe that cesarean sections are necessary and while they're medically actually not. Or there may be financial incentives or concerns of legal consequences. So there's a number of factors which the health systems in countries haven't addressed very well, and that is what this series tries to bring out. So there's a problem.
I look at the states, the countries where it's excessively high, Venezuela 52%, Turkey 53%. I don't necessarily think of them as impoverished, but I don't think of them as wealthy countries either. So it's not. It seems like it's not necessarily just about capital.
That's correct, and I think so. So it's often these middle-income countries, upper-middle-income countries that have very high rates. Also, if we look at those countries, not the richest countries, but we look at poor women and rich women, there may be up to a fivefold difference in the extent to which they get cesarean sections. So within those countries, there are also enormous differences. But even within a country like the U.S., if you look at cesarean section rates by state, there's almost a twofold difference between, say, New Mexico and New Jersey. There's great variation.
Dr. Thies Boerma, the University of Manitoba and the World Health Organization, thanks very much for joining us today. A short conversation, I know, but I appreciate the enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.